Good evening, and welcome to the Majority United Radio, a nonpartisan and non-sexist venue where women can come together to imagine what can be accomplished by empowering women to unite and mobilize with the single goal of ensuring constitutional rights and equality for all. I'm your host, Betty Jean, founder of the Majority United and Women's Coalition, and I'm coming to you tonight from Bergen County, New Jersey. So let me remind you that the Majority United is here every Monday and Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern. And if you don't already follow us, please consider doing so. I would like to tell you a little bit about our guest tonight, Rachel Grant of Rachel Grant Coaching. Here's another wonderful woman that TMU has found, thanks to our new producer, Jocelyn. I'm just so excited about this because we have just been finding some really wonderful young women who we can help network, who not only are we helping them, as we intend to do each week, by getting their word out, but it just makes my soul fly to know how many people we are helping get the messages to. And these women are doing phenomenal work. They're phenomenal women doing phenomenal work. And what Rachel brings to the table is a passionate belief that her clients who have suffered a trauma do not have to be trapped, remain trapped or confronted daily by the thoughts and behaviors that result from abuse. Many of us suffer PTSD, and we know what we go through. So through her journey of recovery from sexual abuse, she has gained insight and understanding about what it comes to overcome abuse. And because she can relate, she can appreciate your struggles. So based on that desire for her to foster community, intimacy, and connection, she has dedicated her time to understanding those relationships and communication. So for her, relating to others and how we relate to others is crucial to improving the overall quality of our lives. So she has developed trauma and recovery relationship coaching programs based on her training, and she has come up with these lessons that she has come from her own journey. Now, she has successfully been working with clients since 2007. Rachel has an MA in counseling psychology. And with this training in human behavior and cognitive development, she is providing this compassionate and challenging approach for her clients while using coaching as opposed to therapeutic models. She's a member of the International Coach Federation and San Francisco Coaches. She's also a board member for Surviving Spirit. That's a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting hope, healing, and help for those impacted by trauma, abuse, or mental health concerns through the use of creative arts. Now, I just spent a great deal of time today. We have one subject that we're going to be doing. Rachel does a lot of interviews, and I have to tell you, I'm really intrigued by the fact that she has different topics, and each interview has been done on different topics. So I just got all engrossed all day today running around checking out all these different topics. Tonight's topic is restoring integrity and boundaries. This one is going to be real special for me to listen to, and I hope that you're all going to really appreciate what Rachel will be bringing for us tonight. Jocelyn Anderson won't be with us tonight, but our producer, Joss, I think wants to test her wings a little bit tonight at producing, co-hosting. So, Joss, if you're there and you would like to introduce yourself and perhaps come out with the first question, we'd be more than happy to have you introduce yourself tonight and try your wings at co-hosting.
Thank you, Betty Jean. I'm very excited to be here tonight with our guest, Rachel Grant. I'd love to start out by going back in time towards the beginning of your work, and I'm wondering, so many survivors don't end up doing something with their experiences the way that you have, and I'm wondering what in your journey inspired you to develop this programming and become a life coach. Could you kind of take us back in time and tell us what began this journey for you?
Sure. Well, thank you, Betty Jean, for that wonderful introduction, and love to hear that you've been out, you know, scoping me out and listening to my interviews and all the great resources that are on my website. Happy to hear that, and good to hear your voice, Jocelyn. I think my journey really began really in my 20s when I finally came clean with myself and said, all right, you know, my life is going a certain direction and I'm experiencing life in a very specific way, and that is tied to the abuse. I had to stop running from the past and become, you know, connected to that experience and own up to it. So I began doing some counseling. I began reading books and wanting to try to come to an understanding about, you know, why I responded to relationships the way I did, why I thought about the way I did about myself. And through that journey, I learned a lot. You know, I had lots of great support, lots of good guidance, but I kept finding myself repeating the same patterns, falling into the same traps, kind of just going around that same mountain over and over again. And when I finally reached my mid-20s, a few experiences really started to open things up for me. And I was in a program and I was thinking a lot about recovery and what it meant for me, and was just kind of reaching that point where enough was enough. I had drawn all sorts of connections. I had all sorts of amazing insights about the abuse, but I just was not getting to that next level. And through a conversation I was having with a friend who was, you know, to her credit, really trying to build me up and lift me up to say, hey, you know what, you know, don't struggle, don't worry about it, you're a survivor, you've made it through all of this, you've gotten so far. And I just kind of popped back and was like, you know what, I don't want to survive my life. I want to live it. I want to be free. I want to get past this. And the more I read, the more work I did, I just really thought, nobody's really answering that question for me about, you know, what do I do about it? How do I actually really move from this place of surviving to what I've now come to coin as the third stage of recovery, beyond surviving? And go ahead.
I wanted to stop you there for just a minute because I think that's an extremely crucial point. Many of us are proud to say, I'm a survivor, without ever realizing that it's not enough to be a survivor. I think you made a very outstanding point. Who wants to just be a survivor? Let's get beyond that. Let's live. I love that. I heard that in one of the interviews earlier today, and that really struck me, and I wanted to ask you to elaborate on that. What does that, saying that, what did that mean to you? What did that do for you? And what can that do for others?
Well, the distinction for me is the difference between somebody who, as a survivor, is identifying themselves as someone who was abused, who is able to talk about the abuse and draw the relationships between their current experience and behaviors and the past, and are wanting to kind of consolidate the experience, come to understand it, come to grips with it, right? And it's an important stage. I don't think it's a stage that you skip, but I also don't think it's the last stage. So when you've been in this place where you've been able to come to an understanding and you can speak about your story, you're no longer ashamed of it, but you're starting to notice, all right, even with all of that, I still, you know, struggle in relationships. I still think about myself negatively. I still, you know, think I'm worthless, or I go around the same mountain when it comes to trusting people, right? I can't seem to cross over that bridge to real trust, real intimacy. I remain on the other side in kind of fear and confusion. And you're at that place where you're like no longer satisfied with just kind of managing the behaviors uh-huh. and coping, but you're really ready to set it aside, to let it go, and be, feel complete about it. The biggest distinction for me is it's kind of like when you fall down and you scrape your knee and you get this scar. And once it's healed, you can see the scar, but you don't feel the same pain as when you actually fell down and hurt yourself.
Right.
And I really think the same thing can occur with past abuse, that you can know that you were abused. It's part of your story. It's part of your experience. But you're not constantly reliving it, feeling it, managing it. And that's beyond surviving.
Very interesting. And so when and how did that happen for you?
Well, so, you know, I definitely reached that point where I thought, all right, I need to start pulling all this together. So in 2005, I started just reading everything I could read, but I really started thinking very specifically about the things that I had come to know that had made a difference for me. I started studying relationships, communication, and pulling and trying to consolidate all of this information into one complete package. And, you know, once I had done that for myself, I thought, I really want to share this with other people, because over and over again, I was talking with survivors who were, you know, craving that. They wanted to have that information of how to make that transition. So I ended up developing a 16-week program called Beyond Surviving that basically takes people from, first of all, understanding on a neurological level what happens as a result of trauma and how to basically rewire the brain so that you can start responding to situations in a different way, so breaking out of certain patterns of behavior, and then really identifying the core kind of false beliefs that a person has and how to challenge those and how to let those go, and then develop, you know, relationship understanding, a new understanding about trust, intimacy, sex, your emotions. And so it took me a minute to, you know, really think about, is this, you know, do I want my story out there? And I think this is something that survivors, kind of circling back around to Jocelyn's initial question, you know, when you have a story that's as intimate and personal as one of abuse, and you have to come to that place of thinking, all right, I know I'm putting myself on the line here. I know my story is going to be out there, and that means people in my family might be impacted, my friends, my partner, myself. But really for me, the ultimate decision came down to, is this really something I can keep to myself, or is it more important that people out there are getting the work and being set free?
That's amazing. I really admire your courage to do that. I'm sure that that wasn't an easy decision for you, and it certainly isn't something that you can take back once it's out there. So I think that you're really brave to use your own story to reach the people that you want to help, because I know that it definitely makes a difference to have a life coach, I imagine, who has been through what your clients are going through.
Yeah. And, you know, just on that part, on a social context, I think that one of the reasons why I decided to share my story is that I also have, I guess, a bit of an agenda. You know, people will be on TV shows, will be on talk shows, and they'll talk about their five affairs they've had, or the fact that they have AIDS, or the fact that they were homeless or addicted to drugs, or all of these, you know, different levels of sharing that you see out there today. But yet somehow there's still this idea that talking about sexual abuse is a big deal, or it's somehow, you know. And so I also kind of want to start nudging at that a little bit and questioning that and wondering, like, is part of the reason why abuse is still so prominent because we still consider it this, you know, kind of side topic that you have to be really brave or you have to be really courageous to speak up about?
Oh, you hit the nail right on the head. This is still the taboo subject, and that's why it is prevalent, because the abusers feel that they can continually get away with it because nobody's going to talk, you know. And then, let's face it, the children are, and women are automatically discounted right off the top. Who believes them?
Yep.
You know.
Yeah.
I think very clearly that, I mean, it has to be, it's all according to who you're ratting on. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hear you on that.
It really depends on who you're ratting on. If you're ratting on some, excuse my French, some jackass, you know, from around the corner, some Joe Schmo, you might be believed. But try ratting on this character that came from France who was going to run for president, and right away the girl will be discounted as nothing more than a prostitute, or somebody who's running for president of the United States. These are all money diggers or whatever. So and children. Well, then somebody put it in their heads. So this is still a very taboo subject where the victim is always re-victimized, and I wonder just how long that's going to go on unless we have more and more people like yourself who are willing to stand up and help us take the fight where it has to go.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the other thing is it's important to that transition from survivor to beyond survivor is also important, because we don't want people to just say, like, this is where I'm stuck and this is my mission. And we want to actually be able to show that there is, you know, life after this. You don't want to become entrenched, because that can be just as dangerous and just as destructive to the social agenda of recovery and everybody who's out there trying to work to build this up and to basically give it a little bit of backbone and respect. You know, when you have people who are just stuck in their stuff for years and years and years and years.
So are you saying that part of this is enabling people to get out of the rut and stop saying poor me and using it as a crutch to not move ahead?
That's right. And, you know, that's part of the reason, you know, my program, the reason why I say, you know, compassionate and challenging is because I basically am saying to my clients and to people who I work with in my course and my workshops, you can no longer use the abuse as your favorite excuse.
Okay. I like that.
Get out of things.
Yeah. Yeah, because
you're, and I certainly
you're
did
right.
that for a long
it's a
time.
Terrible.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
You're right. It's a terrible thing that has happened to those of us who have been abused. But it's even more terrible when we re-abuse ourselves with it and not allow ourselves to move on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, we pick up the baton from the abuser. The abuser's long gone most of the time. They're either dead or they've moved away or they've grown up. You know, they're not even in your space anymore, but we continue to take on, you know, either the things that they told us about ourselves or the things that we came to believe, and we live life reinforcing those. And so, you know, that's where I come in, is to help basically put the brakes on that and turn the corner, go in a different direction.
And that's a good thing that you're doing, because I noticed that a lot of people do that. Not because they're lazy and they want to, but many times it's because this abuse comes right out of their own family, and their family has taught them, keep your mouth shut, you know?
Yep, yeah, and, absolutely.
You know, so, you know, it's very, very sad situation, extremely sad situation. What the outside forces don't do to you, if it happens in your family, your very own family, who you trust and should be able to depend on, you know, put the last nail in your coffin on top of it. So so what you're doing is extremely important. And so how, at this point, you made a decision then, what, back in 2005 to do this for yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I basically decided, all right, enough is enough. I really want the answers to, you know, how I moved past this stage of surviving. So I did some reading, I did some studying, and I started pulling together all of the lessons and all of the information that made a difference for me. And I just recently have finished pulling all of that into a book. So I have finished writing and I'm in the process of putting on final touches for publication and such, Beyond Surviving the Final Stage of Recovery from Sexual Abuse. And this is the guidebook that I use with my clients and in my courses. So basically there are 10 sections, and each section has lessons that include readings and reflection and homework. Because the other key component of this is I did not want a program that was all about just thinking about processing, having great insights. I want my clients to actually get out there and do something. I want them to be in action in their lives. So when they begin to notice, oh, this is the way, like we'll talk a little bit about integrity in a little while, you know, this is the way that I haven't been keeping my word, I haven't been following through, great, let's figure out why that is, what's getting in the way, and as we clear that out, what are you going to commit to this week to go out and keep your word to, or keep your word about? So if they're really taking the lessons and the information and immediately putting it into practice in their lives, that piece was also very, very important to me.
Right. Well, yes. It's not enough to identify a problem. You have to find a solution.
There you go. That was my next question was, it's really interesting how you started to describe your approach. And I'm wondering what's the emphasis on the past versus the future? It sounds like it's pretty future-oriented, but do you have to start with the past in order to get to the future? Right. Well, the past certainly informs the conversation, you know, but I could have a client who is in their present day life experiencing something such as, I don't trust my boyfriend. I cannot, you know, keep my chatting with him every minute of the day. I don't give him any room. Anytime he's not with me, I feel nervous and anxious. And so we start to look at, you know, what are the underlying fears and concerns? And we can take that all the way back, probably to a point of abuse, right, where trust and loyalty was initially broken and the ideas that got developed there. But the great thing about this is that even without that, they are able to work in the present and simply identifying the false beliefs that are driving the reason why the trust isn't happening is enough. So
what do you mean by false beliefs?
I mean, so for instance, let's say that you're having trust and you start to think about, well, you know, what is your real fear or concern why you won't trust your boyfriend? And, you know, a client might say something like, well, I can't trust him because all men are, you know, cheaters. All men will hurt me. All men will take advantage of me, right? So the underlying idea, the underlying false belief there is, you know, men can't be trusted. It might even go a little bit deeper like that, like I'm not worthy of being loved. That actually might be the deeper rooted belief that therefore if I can't be loved, why would this person be loyal to me? Therefore I can't trust him. So when I work with clients, it's always about digging down and digging down to the lowest level, to the most basic layer of fear and concern, and finding that false belief and then challenging it. And we may discover that that false belief, I'm not lovable, comes from being abused, but we don't actually have to go all the way back to the abuse to handle the false belief. We can actually work right here in the present and then get the focus shifted towards the future of what they would like to create for themselves instead. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, that does. Thank you so much. That's fascinating.
Well, yes, that really is. What before we go on, though, I'm very fascinated that you have this kind of insight. Are you working on your doctorate?
Oh, no, I have a doctorate in life, I guess. In experience.
I mean, you certainly do, but I mean, you've written a book, you've devised a plan, you have a 16-week program. Why on earth don't you have a PhD behind your name? I'm listening to you speak, and you are far more articulate on the subject than, you know, many PhDs that I've heard speak.
Thanks. I appreciate that. I suppose, you know, when I was doing my master's in counseling psychology, I was really considering, you know, what my next steps were going to be and weighing how I wanted to approach this work. And as I got into it a little bit more deeply, I really shifted my focus away from therapy and towards coaching for some of those reasons I've mentioned. You know, I'm much more interested in working with people who are just, you know, kind of stuck and they just need to be unstuck and brought to the next level as opposed to diagnosing and looking for disorders. And I also wanted to be able to engage them in a very personal way, being able to share my story, because I think it is wonderful to be able to talk about, I used to be that girl who threw temper tantrums, over here and got very angry and very upset. And, I'm not that girl now. And being able to model that and represent that, I know I certainly needed that and was hoping for that in my journey, to just be able to look at somebody and say, oh, okay, this is what it might look like to actually be out of this, and you can't do that as a therapist. And so when I finished my master's, I thought, okay, that's enough for now. And I'm going to focus on building my business.
Okay, that answers my question. And it also makes a great deal of sense. And it kind of answers why you're so good at what you do. It's because you're really committed to this. And that really answers my question. You're very committed to this, and I now totally understand why. Can you share your story with us?
Sure. I grew up in a small town in Oklahoma, and when I was about 5 years old, I lived with my mom and my dad, and I had an older sister and brother, but they were much older. So when I was around 5 years old, my grandfather moved in with us. And when I was 10, I was the only kid left in the house, and I often helped him. He was older, and so a lot of my time was spent, taking care of him. We didn't have a very close relationship, but I certainly was caring and take him his cereal at night and help him out onto the porch when he wanted to sit. And one day we were going out. I was holding the door for him to come out onto the porch, and he grabbed my arm and took me with him to the swing. And we were sitting there, and as, a 10-year-old child, I'm thinking, oh, okay, I guess, I'm going to hang out with my grandpa today, and we're just going to sit on swing and have a chat or whatever. But that was the first time he began molesting me. And this happened for quite some time and to various degrees of touching. And there are times where there's sort of a memory, don't really fully get it, don't really remember if that's what happened. There are some things that are very clear and very specific. And just as a way of illustration, the first time that that happened, I basically was paralyzed, didn't really understand it. I'm a 10-year-old girl, I'm just barely developing, have no idea really what sex is, have a gist of it, but no idea. All I knew is that I was scared, it didn't feel right, it was uncomfortable. And so I eventually pulled myself away from the swing, and I went running inside the house, and I went running back to my parents' bedroom, just kind of threw myself across their bed, and I was crying, sobbing. And I remember thinking, like, why doesn't anyone come and check on me? They should be hearing me cry. Isn't that what parents do? Like, I'm crying. Somebody should be coming. And nobody did. And here's that moment where a false belief kind of gets born. It's like sometimes we identify very specific moments when we come to believe something. And in that moment, I started to believe that I was on my own, that I was by myself. And so jump ahead 20 years later, I'm doing the work around this. I'm noticing that this is a story that has been in the background through all of my teen years, all of my 20s, this I've got to do it on my own, I'm by myself, I can't depend on anyone, right? So when I started to look at the actual experience, I realized, man, my mom wasn't even home. How was she going to come and help me, right? But in the mind of the child, it's totally twisted. So I'm able to look at what happened, identify, oh, wait a minute, it's not that she wasn't there to help me. It wasn't that she heard me and she ignored me. It wasn't that I was on my own. It was that she was in another room. She wasn't home. My dad wasn't there. And that's what happened. So I don't have to be on my own. I don't have to do things all by myself.
I see.
Thank you so much, Rachel, for sharing that with us tonight. I'm sure that a lot of listeners are identifying with parts of her story or all of it. And I just had a follow-up question regarding, you said that your mom wasn't home. You, after working in this field for a number of years, at this point, how do you feel about prevention of child abuse? Do you think that there's anything that could have changed what happened I don't know whether that's communication about body and boundaries, but where do you stand on ways to prevent child abuse from happening?
Right. Yeah, there are so many great organizations out there doing so much great work on this topic. And for me, my personal thought on it is you definitely have to start by teaching children at a very young age that if anything happens to them, to their body, that they can talk, they can tell you. And it needs to be explicit. We can't tiptoe around it. You know, we have to be able to say, just as I need to be able to say very specifically, I was abused, and not hiccup and not be afraid of it, we need to be able to tell our children, look, if somebody touches you here, if somebody touches your vagina, if somebody tries to kiss you, if somebody shows you pictures that you don't like, if somebody talks to you in a way that you don't like, you come and tell me, and if I don't listen, you go and tell another person. If that person doesn't listen, you go and tell another person. I think there's all those pieces that have to be in place. It has to be first education about what abuse is and what counts as abuse, empowerment to basically speak up and say what's going on, and to have the resilience and teaching resilience to be able to, even if you get turned down, even if somebody says, I don't believe you, to go on to the next person and go on to the next person and to know who those people would be.
I completely agree with you. I think one of the problems is that we continue to give children the message that bad guys, you can tell who the bad guys are since you can in all the video games and all the TV and movie programs. Kids always know who the bad guys are, and even young children know the story of, here, little girl, do you want some candy? But what they don't ever learn is that people that they know and people that they trust could also violate that. So it's a fine line between us not wanting to scare children and make them fear for their life every day at school and in the neighborhood. So I'm not sure how we're going to work towards that, but I completely agree with you that parents developing communication around this would be a good place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. I nannied for a really long time, and I took care of a young boy and a young girl. And when the little girl was, she was around three, I started having this conversation with her, you know, with the parents' permission, of course. But I would say to her, look, if this happens to you, if anyone, if your mom, if your dad, I named the people, like if your mom, your dad, your brother, your aunt, me, I said, if I ever touch you in a way that you don't like, you either tell me right away or you tell your mom, you know, giving that total global playing field of like anybody's up for grabs and making it okay to say something regardless of who it is, I think is really important.
Yeah. There's that's very good advice. It's extremely good advice. And it's a good step in the right direction. Of course, I wish it was just as simple as that.
Oh, man, I know. There's so many things.
I wish it was just that simple. But that's very good advice, and it will suffice for many, you know, in many instances. Mm-hmm. Did you ever attempt to tell anybody what happened, or were you so traumatized by no one coming when you were only 10 years old, that you just decided then and there that nobody would have come, and so you weren't going to say anything anyway?
I don't even know if I had it on a very conscious level. I think mostly I was unsure of what I would even say, right?
Right.
Well, how do I even describe what's happening? I don't even have the language to necessarily discuss what's going on. And I think for me, I really became very reclusive and just kind of fell into myself. And eventually what happened was we were on the swing and my mom walked by the window and she looked out and saw what was happening. And, you know, she came tearing out onto the porch and, you know, drug me inside. And that's an interesting moment as well, because of her response, she was yelling at me, right? Rachel, get in the house. Come here right now, which is what you do to a child who's, like, done something wrong.
Right, who's misbehaving.
Right. And so that was another moment where one of my key false beliefs got triggered around it being my fault. Like, oh, she's yelling at me. She's not yelling at my grandfather. And it was only until years later, again, when I use these skills and these tools that I teach, that I looked at that from a very different perspective and thought, you know, man, she was scared out of her mind. She just wanted to get me away from him. She didn't know what to do either. you know. And so I was able to let go of that idea that it was my fault. But they were great. You know, they got him out of the house.
Was it her father or your father's father?
It was her father.
It was her father?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, you know, they got him, they moved him out of the house right away, and that was great. But it was only until many, many years later I was having a conversation with my mom, and she thought, it turned out, that that was the only time that it had ever happened. And that was actually, you know, months and months in to the abuse. So, you know, communication, and imagine that. I mean, imagine the two different lives we're leading, even as mother and daughter, where not that, you know, more abuse is better or, you know, counts more, because, you know, as little abuse as you have, it counts. I always say there's no competition in trauma. But it's just, it's her perspective and my perspective were so very different. And so, you know, being able to communicate with the people around you as well about your experience is important, and knowing how to talk to them about it, knowing how to give them information, is also another thing that I work around a lot with my clients.
That was actually my next question, because I've heard a lot of my peers talk about how hard it is to bring topics like abuse up in conversation when they've experienced it, but also for supporters, in your case, like your mother, could you address both sides? How does either the survivor or the supporter bring this up? It doesn't come up in your everyday life, so can you explain some of the tools that you teach your clients regarding this type of communication?
Well, I think when it comes to a survivor who wants to share their story, who wants to talk about their story, there's a very particular model or method that I teach that involves not just telling the experience, and I've kind of been modeling it as I've been telling you all my story. I don't just say, oh, well, this was the moment and this is what happened. I actually go on to tell you what I came to believe or think and how I got past that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because what we want to show to the people who are supporting us is our journey, the places where we're still stuck and the places where we're still hurting and maybe confused and struggling, but also how we actually move from the point of the experience to understanding the false belief or interpretation that we have as a result of it and how we moved past that so that they know how to relate to us, right? Because if you tell somebody, oh, I was, you know, sexually abused, and that's the end of your sentence, you know, that's a whole can of worms. They don't know, well, how much are you still dealing with? How much do you still struggle? What are your main fears or concerns? What are your difficulties? So being able to structure telling your story in a way that's about being able to give very specific information that gives them a clear and total picture of your journey, I think is a really wonderful and powerful thing to be able to do.
I like that you put the responsibility on the survivor, because I think that too often people are disappointed when they're not asked or they're not supported in the way that they want, but if you take it upon yourself to clearly tell someone what you need and what you're going through, I think you have a better chance of getting the support you're hoping for, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. We can't, this is the thing, you know, with people, when we're abused, you know, people don't really all know how to support us. We can't make the assumption that they'll just give us the type of support that we need. It's very different from, you know, if we see somebody with a broken leg, you know, we know what to do. We shout like hell. We call the ambulance. We get over there. We splint the leg or whatever. But with something like I've been, you know, emotionally and sexually abused, that's, you know, deer in the headlights for a lot of people. So our part of our journey as moving from survivor to beyond survivor is that you are responsible. You take responsibility and you own your experience and you own the communication about it and set people up in your life so that they can support you and love you and care for you with as little confusion as possible by being very clear. And the second part of your question there about, you know, people who are on the support side, right, the people who are around us who are supposed to, you know, to be supporting us, somebody's dog. We want to, that's cute. We want to, you know, set them up for success and tell them what we need, you know, and then also be willing to ask them, you know, what it's like for them and what are their fears and concerns, because they have them. They're there, you know, when they, I remember having conversations with my mom where she thought, you know, I was just going to blame her forever and, you know, I was never going to be able to forgive her. And I never actually blamed her at all, right? So being able to have those conversations with the support people or the, you know, people who are also involved in your family to hear their side, it doesn't mean that your experience is invalidated by whatever they say, but it is good to know what, you know, ideas that they've walked away with about either themselves or the experience.
Well, okay. I have a couple of questions I'd like to ask. I just got a couple of emails, by the way, that that they're unable to get into the chat room. So I noticed that we didn't have anybody in there, and I was wondering why. And then I got a couple of emails that people are not able to get into the chat room. Those of us that are in the chat room are those of us who are producers and co-hosts. But there's no one else in there, and I'm told that they can't get in there. So my deepest apologies. I don't know what the problem is. I've alerted our assistant producer to... see if he can figure it out, but I don't know that he can right now. So I apologize that I lost track there for a minute. I was trying to attend to some of our listeners trying to get in with us, and they cannot. What I would like to ask is, the topic of our show tonight was integrity, and I thought that was a very interesting way of putting this, because if you don't have I got so distracted that I wound
no,
up
it's understandable.
I lost what I was trying to say, but restoring integrity and boundaries, I find this extremely interesting, and I want to get to it so that our listeners understand, because if you can't deal with the integrity, is that what you're trying to say? If you can't deal with the integrity of what happened, if you can't see it, feel it, talk about it, get it out, and share it, then how will you deal with it? Am I in the right direction?
Not quite, but that's actually a very interesting interpretation, and I kind of am intrigued by that, actually, that being able to incorporate this part of your story and this part of your experience and own it will lead you to leaving a more integrous life, as opposed to when you're hiding it, you know, concealing it, that kind of thing.
Do you mean then by restoring integrity to our lives?
Right. Well, so I think that what happens with abuse is there are basically, you know, lots of areas that are impacted by abuse, but one, when it comes to integrity and our ability to kind of live honestly, we really begin to struggle to speak up for ourselves, to ask for what we need, or honestly communicate what we think or feel about a situation. So we feel compelled to conceal or to hide our genuine thoughts or feelings, which ultimately that means hiding ourselves. And that really is a result of what we had to do when it came to the abuse, right? So you think about, you know, my circumstance and many experiences of people who have been abused. The moment happens, the abuse begins, and then the next minute, you know, you're sitting in your living room with your family and you're watching TV and somebody says, "How are you doing?" And you say, "I'm okay." And there's like this immediate disconnect from your voice. There's an immediate disconnect from your ability to speak up for yourself, to ask for what you need, to say what you really mean. And then the second impact is that we lose our ability to set and keep boundaries, right? So we find ourselves often saying or doing things that are not aligned with our authentic selves because of this. So restoring integrity if you think about a bike wheel, right, and the wheel has a function. It's supposed to roll. It's supposed to keep you moving, yeah? Well, if the tire has to be inflated, the spokes have to be in place, the hub of the wheel has to be solid, and if any one of those components is missing, then the integrity of that wheel is gone, right?
Right.
So similarly, we have spokes in our lives like peacefulness, love, companionship, money, career, health, and honesty, keeping our word, our language, and boundaries. And so when any of these areas are out of balance, our lives become wobbly. We just, you know, we're missing something. So in order to set back into balance our relationship to word and our ability to set boundaries, we start with this idea of integrity and restoring integrity.
Right.
Hmm. Yeah. You have the most clever metaphors. Where do you come up with these tires and scrapes and all the different metaphors that you've shared with us tonight?
Oh, my teen years as a poet, I guess. It aches.
Have you ever considered spoken word poetry? I bet you could write some really powerful pieces.
I dabbled in that a little bit in my younger years. Yeah, for sure. I still write a little bit from time to time. It's been a long time since I've read any of my poetry on a stage, but yeah.
It would be great if you could find a way to incorporate that into your workbook, since like channeling your emotions is a therapeutic way to express them, wouldn't you say?
Nice. I like that. I'm putting that as a note. Reversion 2.
You have to put a footnote giving me some credit for that, please.
I will. I will. As inspired by.
So in one of these books, we're going to see this, you know, a mention. Yeah. I get it.
Right.
Yeah. I'm just jockeying for a spot there. I see it. So you believe that abuse automatically and immediately impacts our ability to live honestly. And I can see exactly what you mean by that and why you would have what the importance is of restoring that integrity to our lives. Because you can't. What are you supposed to say? I'm not fine. Somebody just molested me. I mean, I can't even begin to think that that would be an answer, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right. So this is why my definition of integrity comes down quite literally to language, right? So my very simplified definition of integrity is saying what you mean and meaning what you say. So that whenever you make a promise, whenever you give your word, it's about really doing that with the full intention of following through with that, taking whatever action you have to take in order to make sure that it actually happens. And as much as possible, trying to avoid using language in ways that are, kind of lazy or not intentional. So, you know, I mean, and I'm definitely fall into this at times where you say something like, I'm never going to talk to you again. And you know you don't mean it, but, you know, you're basically degrading your word when you don't fully take on the fact that what you say matters and what you say means something. And if you can't follow through on it, then every time that happens, it's like the thread between you and the person that you're communicating with becomes weaker and weaker and weaker. And so your relationships become more difficult, your relationships become not as meaningful or connected or grounded because of that as well.
That makes a lot of sense. Don't say things you don't mean, no matter how minute they might seem. Mm-hmm. I can understand that, especially if you're dealing with a young person who's still in the concrete stage, right?
Right, right. I mean, language is so extremely powerful. It is so amazingly powerful, and we just don't always give it its due credit. And because we become disconnected from our voice, you know, part of the work to do is to just simply reconnect. And so, you know, the language, instead of being a tool for hiding a deception, can really become a tool for setting boundaries, communicating powerfully, and expressing what it is that you need and desire. So, you know, I like to work, and here's a little caveat, though, because by no means do I want people to become kind of robotic about communication. I don't want somebody to be like, I will be there at 2 o'clock p.m. on Tuesday, and if I don't, you know, I'm a very bad person and I broke my word. I want it to be more about being intentional and being conscious, just being aware, like, what are you saying, what are you doing? And whenever possible, when you know that you're going to have to break a promise, getting into communication as soon as you can, because that actually, you know, fosters the relationship and protects the relationship a bit more. And so it's not about finding fault with another person. Like, if somebody shows up late, you know, you're not judging them and saying, oh, you're out of integrity. It's not a, something like a wand or a sword, you know, to wave about in order to try or slice others up or slice yourself up. But it's about reconnecting with language. And through that, you begin to feel the power of your voice. You begin to feel your ability to make decisions, your ability to make choices and express yourself. And sometimes, starting with something very small and simple, like, if I say I'm going to be here at 5, by God, I'm going to be there at 5. Not the actual being on time. It's about the process of noticing what it feels like when you give your promise and your word to something and you follow through.
Right. Because that means a lot to the person who's hearing it, whether or not you can be trusted, you know, and it is a matter of trust. I really fully understand what you mean. I think I got a little bit, somebody else has got a dog too, huh?
Guilty, not me. That's me. That's me over here. Sorry, apologies.
Integrity of our pets, I think.
I'll try and ask my question over the dog's yapping. I was wondering, what's the relationship to setting boundaries to all of this? I know from reading some of the work on your website that you do a lot of work around setting boundaries and communicating what those are. How does that relate to living a life of integrity?
Right. So, you know, as our word, or in this sense, you know, a promise, becomes more and more degraded over time, our ability to set and keep boundaries also suffers. So we struggle to say no, if we say no at all, or when we do say no, we end up caving all the time. So we make commitments that we don't follow through on, which then loses the sense that our promises to ourselves or to others really matter at all. And the ultimate outcome is that we fail to set or keep boundaries. And the double-edged sword there is that that leads us to feeling guilty, ashamed, inadequate, and so we just repeat the pattern, right? We just keep going around and around and around. And, you know, the idea, you know, there are a lot of topics out there about boundaries and what it really means. And, you know, I think there's a lot of language out there about, you know, it's, you know, setting up a perimeter around you and all these sorts of things. I think it's really more a matter of coming into a place of being able to respect and honor yourself and trusting yourself. And that's the other big whammy about boundaries, that when we've been abused, our understanding of our ability to make good choices and to set a boundary becomes a bit skewed or tampered with as a result of abuse. So by first becoming connected again to your word and learning to keep, you know, your promises on small things like showing up on time, then the next time you make a promise about, you know what, I can only see you 2 times a week because the more I see you, the harder it is for me to get my work done, or some other sort of boundary that might be more difficult, you are more likely to be able to succeed with that because you've reconnected with, you know, your honor and integrity and your voice.
That makes a lot of sense. Can you tell me what is it about, not just for me, but, you know, this will be aired later, and I want it for those who need to hear this. What is it about having been through, you know, abuse that puts that ruins the ability to be honest? Is it because you had to not tell someone what happened to you and keep the guilt to yourself? Is that what destroyed the integrity in the first place?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much at the root of it. We, you know, it's kind of a bold statement, but we basically all become liars. And we become very adept at covering up, hiding. The amazing thing is that we express this covering up in all sorts of ways. You know, we might gain a lot of weight. You know, a lot of women, I certainly went through this, give up their femininity, right? So this is a loss of integrity around so many different things, not just our voice. But when you basically are forced to sit with people and say, yeah, I'm great, life is good, things are going well, but you're going home and things are happening to you that shouldn't be happening to any child, you basically, it's just a disconnection between what you say and what you're doing. And so you find yourself starting to lie about little things, anything.
Right.
You know, it's just like, well, what does it matter? I just, you know, make up any story and I'll say anything.
That's the point that I was trying to get at, so that people can kind of understand how that happens, as mm-hmm. why that would play a role into that, what causes one to get to a point where, why should, you know, this is very important, what happened to me, and I can't tell that, so what else would I have to tell the truth about that is mm-hmm. as important as this thing I'm hiding, kind
yeah.
of, right, to a little child's mind, let's say?
Yeah, and to me, this is one topic that I don't hear being talked about very much in recovery. You'll hear a lot about abandonment. You'll hear a lot about trust and intimacy and guilt and shame, but this concept of, are you actually connected to your core? Are you connected to who you are, with your voice, with your word? You know, it doesn't get a lot of airplay out there, and so it's really important to me that people come to understand that this, in so many ways, is a starting point.
Absolutely. I'm fascinated by it. That's why I'm asking so many questions that may seem really primary or primal, but I do want anyone listening who, you know, may not be able to understand it from a deep point, if we can bring it, you know, very, very... I want to make it as simple as possible for people
yeah.
to understand, if I made myself clear.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, I hope we're getting there. I mean, I guess what I would say additionally about it is that, you know, if you want to experience, you know, that sensation of, you know, authenticity and freedom in your life, that being able to start in your own little small ways, in your own little world, is so important. You know, we sometimes try to go from 0 to 60, and that just never works. We really have to think about small incremental steps. So when it comes to something like reconnecting with your voice and letting go of, you know, lying, letting go of pretending, letting go of covering up, you know, pick one small thing that you can give your word to this week that you can follow through on. You know, this is the action part of things. You know, don't just take this as an idea and go, oh, that's a great idea. Think about, all right, well, you know, what have I been saying yes to this week that I've been blowing off? Or who's that person who I keep saying, yeah, we'll get dinner, and I never, ever call? Or, you know, what's that, you know, one snack that I keep saying I'm going to give that up and I just don't? You know, whatever it is, one small thing. And notice, you know, for the next, you know, 2 weeks, every day, like giving your word to that, noticing, remaking that promise with yourself every morning and going through. And if you don't do it, if you fail, if you miss the boat, that's okay. It's not bad or wrong. Just take that as an opportunity to get curious. Like, well, what got in the way of that today? You know, what fear came up for me, or what worry came up, or, you know, what desire got in the way and caused me to not keep my word, and
right.
learn from that.
Right. I think that this is really a very important concept. I know we spend a great deal of time on it, but I really hope those listening now or who will be listening later with the podcast. And let me just remind everyone, this is a podcast that's available on demand. So please feel free to take the link that you're listening to at this time and pass this link on, because it'll live forever as long as the internet's alive. this is a very important broadcast tonight. Rachel Grant is with us. Rachel can be reached at Rachel Grant. Give me the RachelGrantCoaching.com. And
that's right.
I really want you to go there, because the information on this website is it's just amazing. You'll find testimonials. You'll find information about Rachel. You'll find trauma recovery. You'll find packages. There's even a free 60-minute session available there to get you started. She has a blog, and all her blog posts, recent blog posts, are available there. Other topics are available there. You can sign up for Rachel's newsletter so that you can receive articles, specials, and helpful insights. She even has free media where you can listen to some of the other radio shows. You can reach Rachel by writing to coach@rachelgrantcoaching.com. So, and she can be found on Facebook and Twitter. So it's really important that you get in touch with this wonderful young woman, because I've rarely found anyone that I have found this fascinating. I'm going to be doing some real work on her website, looking out for myself, because I just find this totally fascinating, Rachel. Where do we go from here now? What's the next thing that we want to talk about? I just had to take a little station break and kind of...
I love that.
Tell everybody.
I was going to suggest that we talk about positive affirmations and negative talk. I know that that's an issue. A lot of the topics we've addressed tonight, people can relate to, whether or not they have histories of trauma. So I'm sure a lot of the listeners tonight would appreciate some tools as to how to deal with negative talk and what suggestions you may have around that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now this comes down to the integrity of your word to yourself, right? So the way that you talk to yourself or about yourself is representative of the sort of relationship that you have around the integrity to self. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, language really is at the starting point for transformation, in my opinion. So when you start to identify that you have negative patterns of thought, and we all do this, you're absolutely right, Jocelyn, regardless of whether we've been abused or not, we all have experiences in life that are difficult, that throw us for a loop, that leave us wondering or questioning who we are or others. We develop these patterns of negative thought in the moment. So whenever something happens, the brain basically becomes wired to connect that experience, that moment, with a very particular response, thought, or feeling. And so that's what PTSD is, right? We actually have a moment that causes trauma, that causes these biological, emotional sensations, and then 2 years later, we're in a place where the same smell is there, or a face that looks familiar is there. And all that happens is the neuronal pathways that hold that memory get lit up, and we're re-experiencing all of the same emotions. So the same thing can happen with a thought. So the first intervention is to basically, whenever a thought occurs, to intercept it by challenging the truth of it. So, like, if a thought might occur, like, I am worthless, right? The first line of defense is to actually really just say out loud, I am valuable, or whatever alternative word or phrase feels powerful and empowering for you. And so it's not the total cure, but it's at least like pouring the booze down the drain. You know, it stops the brain from continuing on the path of reinforcing the negative thought. So it's a little first step in the right direction.
Yeah, sure. It's like putting up a roadblock or a detour sign.
Mm-hmm.
you know, forcing you to, no, we're not going to go that way today. We're just going to do something different. I think that's a very useful tool.
Is that a tool that you can kind of use with your with other people? If you hear people around you saying self-deprecating comments, does it work to just say, you're not stupid, you're the smartest person I know, or how does that work with other people?
Oh, good question. Yeah. Well, so if you try to just rephrase for them, then basically they'll just dismiss, right? And actually, when you're rephrasing for yourself, your brain tries to dismiss because it's kind of like the neurons go, wait a minute, I don't know that programming. I don't like how that sounds or feels. And so when you say to somebody else, oh, no, you're not stupid. You're really capable. You're really able to, you know, do things. They just kind of go, yeah, okay. And then the brain just keeps going on in its other way. So the way to intervene on the behalf of others is to just simply begin asking questions, right? Like, I hear you really saying that, you know, you think that you're not capable. I'm wondering, you know, where that comes from. You know, when did you start to think that about yourself? And trying to get them to notice, like, oh, you know, I really had this really bad experience one time, and then helping them look for the alternative explanations for why that might have happened, right? Intervening on that level of, well, it doesn't sound like you were really incapable in that situation. I'm wondering if it was more like your boss wasn't listening to you or your teacher wasn't being very helpful, giving them some alternative interpretations and then helping them, you know, maybe say, what do you think might else have been going on there? Because that's the second layer of challenging negative thinking. It's not only to just replace the thought with something positive, but actually figure out, well, why is this in my world anyway? Like, why is this a part of my, you know, special soup of crazy, so to speak? And once you do that, you're like, okay, this, yes, I get that's there, but why is that there? And then just like with the it's my fault or I'm on my own, like I could switch those and start saying I can count on other people or I'm not responsible. But until I got down to that second layer of saying, well, let me look and see what actually was going on there, every time you do that, it's not because you're trying to find some real truth. Let me just make that distinction. It's not because any one of these things is actually the truth. It's that every time you do that, every time you challenge the initial interpretation, the initial reason, you're weakening the strength of that neuronal connection. You're making your brain go, oh, maybe not. Oh, maybe not. Oh, maybe it was this. What if it was that? So the next time something happens that triggers that same pathway and, you know, your I'm stupid pathway gets lit up, you now have incorporated a whole host of countering thoughts that will be there as well. And the more you do that, the less often the thought will actually be triggered at all, or if it is, the more quickly you can navigate your way out of it.
I like that. It's kind of like antibodies to a negative virus.
Yeah. I call it training the mind. I mean, it's really like we do exercise for our muscles, you know, we diet or we, you know, eat healthy or we do push-ups to build our muscles. This is about building the muscle of your mind.
Yeah, I love that.
I think that's really interesting, and I appreciate those comments because I feel very passionate about what actions we can take to not support, not fuel our negative talk. So at the leadership program I worked at this summer with adolescent teenage girls, we encourage them to think about what fuels their negative talk, such as how many magazines do they read every week and how much time do they spend on Facebook staring at pictures of other people. Most people, there have been studies that show that they feel worse about their lives and themselves after spending a certain amount of time on Facebook. So I think that besides retraining our minds, we can look at what actions we're taking instead of, and not even just, let's not read magazines, not do Facebook, but what are positive actions that we can take to feel better about ourselves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that.
I like that too. That's really good. Now, how do we learn that it's okay to use our voice and speak our truth without being afraid that we're going to, you know, scare the person off and they're not going to want to be our friend anymore?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, first of all, you have to just start doing some data collection, right? If we come in with the idea that speaking our story is going to lead to people leaving us, people thinking less of us, you know, there may be that person that has that response. It's not impossible. It could happen.
It's probably more probable than not lately, but go ahead.
But there are plenty of people out there who are not going to respond that way. And so when you start to take little steps, right, to trust and to open up, you don't want to just throw the gauntlet down for anybody.
Right.
But it's kind of this idea of you will see what you're looking for. So, our perspective and our frame and our focus really shapes very profoundly what we think is happening. And so if we go into a conversation saying this person is going to reject me, this person isn't going to accept me, man, they could, you know, come singing, you know, praises, and we would ignore it.
Exactly.
Completely.
Yeah, like what do you want, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly, yeah. Right? So by focusing on, you know, maybe one small thing that you want to do this week to, you know, share your story, to speak it to, and it doesn't have to be a story about abuse, right? People get, you know, verklempt about just sharing anything about themselves, right?
Right.
So being able to just say, you know what, this week I'm going to try to talk to such and such about blank, and go into it, you know, with confidence, and assures that you can do that and you can speak clearly. And then very importantly, when that conversation is over, have a very distinct conversation with yourself. How did that go? How do I feel? Did the walls cave in on me? Did they go away laughing at me? Really process what actually happened in response to your sharing, because most of the time we think that all sorts of things are going badly, but it's actually very rarely happening. And most of the times, people are relieved. People really appreciate when we share ourselves with them. It's a gift that we give to other people when we open up and we tell them what our experience is, what our needs are, what our desires are.
Okay. Do you suggest that we are careful about who we attempt to open up to in the first place, being very selective?
Well, that's a tricky question because, you know, we can be so careful. We think we're being careful, but really all we're doing is just putting up, you know, barriers and boundaries and, you know, unscalable walls. And so there's a delicate balance to find between thinking about what you will tell a person, how much and when, and what you're going to use to kind of measure whether or not you can trust them with certain information but not other information. So a lot of the, I have a whole different teaching topic on trust, mm-hmm. and defining what that really is, and thinking about what it means to really develop relationships. A lot of times what we end up trying to do is we try to be controlling, right? Try to manage everything, manipulate people, try to put all sorts of stop gaps in place so that we're not hurt, so that they can't get at us, when really what we need to learn to do is to be open and vulnerable, but learn how to manage risk. It's the difference between just being in control and being controlling. You want the first, not the latter.
I think that's important to teach people the difference between the two.
Yeah, I should come back and talk about trust.
Actually, I think maybe we should set you up to do that in a few weeks, come back and talk about trust, because that is a long one, and it's an important one. I think, why I asked the question this late in the show, because those of us who have PTSD and have been through multiple traumas, let's say, and have multiple PTSD, have a real problem with trust and being able to get to the point of using their voice to speak to the truth, not feeling free to be able to, being very careful who they will speak to. I mean, I've kept things, you know, for almost 60 years. You know, and many people have because, you're taught to do that, first of all. And yet, other people who have known me would have never thought I could keep my mouth shut about anything, anywhere, for any period of time, because I'm not that kind of a gal.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Have you found in your work, Rachel, that there's a lot of differences in the age that people start doing this work or the gender? Can you make any generalizations about that?
I think one thing I'm noticing is that younger women are starting to show up. I think that generation is a bit more empowered to seek help. There's still a lot of, you know, I was actually talking with some coach colleagues the other day about, you know, what gets in the way of people stepping up and, you know, seeking help. And there are all sorts of generational things that I think are at play. One thing that I'm noticing is that the male population, quite a few of my clients are actually men right now. And so I think, you know, while by no means for women are we done, you know, breaking down the barriers to being able to talk and share our stories, it's definitely much further along than it is for men. And boy, if we think it's taboo for a woman to identify as a survivor or somebody who's been abused or to talk about their story, for a man, you know, still, it can be very, very difficult. So they are very often re-traumatized by opening up and sharing. But this seems to be a new battlefront and a lot of progress being made about that. And so more and more male clients are coming to me and seeking support.
Yeah. That is something that I've been seeing a lot more of. Men are beginning to step forward and say, hey, it's been me too. And I'm glad to see that happening because if they didn't, we would never understand. We're beginning to understand with each other why we react to some of the ways that we react, but we've never quite understood, you know, maybe why some of the men have reacted the way they've reacted. And I'm not talking about abusers. I'm talking about, you know, some of the problems that we ourselves face. Fear of rejection and fear of intimacy and all kinds of things like that that is the result of trauma like this. Well, men are facing that too, and we just chalked it up to maybe something different.
They usually get busted with the, oh, he just can't commit, right? We throw them under that bus of, you know, they just want to stay wild or they just want to sow their oats or, you know, all of that. When a lot of times the barriers to intimacy and trust for them are abuse as well.
Exactly. So I think that's very important, you know, when, you know, again, when anyone, I don't just mean males, when whoever is not using it as we open the show as a crutch. So, but I do. I think we've, again, I want to go back and because we're almost out of time, and I want to talk about your website. I want to talk about the fact that it's coach at rachelgrantcoaching.com. If you want to reach Rachel and ask some questions or make an appointment to find out more. There are sessions, there are packages, there's relationship coaching, there's just everything that you could possibly want. I don't think I've ever found a website, by the way, and it's called rachelcoaching.com. I've never seen a website that is so well put together because it has, really, I was beyond myself because I could find everything, you know, it was about... And then it taught, you know, about the trauma recovery, everything about the coaching and the packages. And then there was, like, all the latest news and testimonials and then your blog posts, how to get a newsletter, all this free media, how to get connected to you either by mail or by phone and how to connect with you through IN and I don't know that other little thing, but Facebook and Twitter. I mean, everything is right there, and you just make it so easy to, I mean, there's support meetings, and, you know, this is just really, you bowled me over with what you've done. You're phenomenal. It's been a pleasure to get to know you, because I feel like someday you're going to be a great name, and we're going to be able to say, well, gee, we knew her when. No. And I
awesome.
Hope you're going to remember us when you're
of
famous.
Course.
That.
Of course.
You know. Also, I want Joss to schedule you again for some time in the, you know, in the future year, not too far away, to come back and talk about trust. Because I think
we'll do that. Yeah, I'd be happy to do that.
You know, if you don't mind, again, please, everyone, I want you to go to RachelGrantCoaching.com. There's just something for everyone, because we've been there. And we need to help. And if
and
anybody
you know,
is gal to help us, this is the gal to help us. Is there anything, Rachel, that you would that we haven't touched on that you would like to add before we end tonight?
Well, I do just want to say that the PDF version of the book I am selling for $10. So. If people want to get a copy of the PDF version of the Beyond Surviving, the Final Stage of Recovery from Sexual Abuse, they can email me or call me, and I'll take their payment information and email them the PDF. So just so they know that that's available as well as a resource.
That I missed, and I so totally apologize.
It's not on the website. It's not. It's not out there. It's not.
Okay.
It's not listed.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want one. I'll be your first customer. I want one.
Okay.
And how do they can pay for that with PayPal, credit card? What? How do we do it?
They can call me and I can get a credit card, or they can send a PayPal payment to coach@rachelgrantcoaching.com and just put in the note memo for PDF version, and I will send one right away.
Okay.
So if you want to do that by PayPal, that's probably the easiest way.
Okay.
And, as far as final thoughts, I just I really want to appreciate you and Jocelyn for hosting tonight and, you know, leading the conversation so wonderfully and giving me this opportunity to share my story and the work that I do. It's really been an amazing journey, and it's wonderful to be here at this stage in my life where, you know, days can be, you know, struggling no matter what. You know, we all have those days, but the best thing that I've learned and come to understand is that there are some amazing tools and there are some amazing strategies and ways that we can move ourselves through those moments, and that there are really some very clear, specific ways to feel complete and finished with certain aspects of the past and the abuse, and to just move on, live freely. You know, really, like, give the gift to yourself. You don't have to stay there. You don't have to stay in that middle place of just surviving. You really can embrace your life, live free, breathe again, and really become the person that you really were meant to be, like, to shed all of the layers that got put on you because of abuse and really reveal yourself again as who you truly are.
Well, Rick, you certainly have done that for yourself and really revealed yourself and lived your life for the person that you really are. And I have to tell you, I can't thank you enough for coming and being with us tonight. You truly are a majority united woman, and I thank you.
Thank you, Betty Jean.
And I look forward to having you again with the next portion of this, which would be called Truth. Thank you, and thank you, Jocelyn, for pitching in tonight and being my co-host. This was a wonderful show. Please do remember to send this out to everyone to play so that they can listen to this. It's downloadable on demand. You can listen to it on your iPod or whatever other listening devices that you have. Join us again on Monday night, when we have 6-time Emmy award-winning producer, writer, director, Madeline Pollock. See you again tonight. This is Betty Jean from the Majority United Radio. Good night, and I need you like I need fresh air. Love you all. See you Monday. Good night.